Chapter 18. It didn't take long for Crescent Thorn to fall into a pattern. As Thorn became more comfortable with the movements of the sand underneath them and the sensation of the cane in his hand, he grew more confident, and their pace increased. 3 dunes. 5. 10. Before long, Cress realized that it took a lot less energy to stay in the valleys between the dunes when they could. So she began cutting a slower yet less exhausting zigzag route across the desert. As she walked, the towels around her feet began to loosen and grains of sand slipped in and got caught between her toes, despite how tight Thorn had tied the ropes of hair. The soles of her feet began to burn, and a cramp was threatening to overtake her left foot from the constant grab and release of her toes on the unstable ground. Her legs ached. Cress's body began to rebel as they rambled up yet another dune. Her thighs would burn as she crested one more hill. But then her shins would cry out as they descended the other side. Her silly fitness routines aboard the satellite hadn't prepared her for this. But she did not complain. She panted a great deal. She swiped at the sweat drops on her temples. She clenched her jaw against the hurt, but she did not complain. At least she could see, she reminded herself, and at least she didn't have to carry the supplies. She heard Thorn switch shoulders from time to time, but he didn't complain either. Sometimes, when they struck a flat spot, she closed her eyes to see how long she could go without opening them. Vertigo would set in almost immediately. Panic would blossom at the base of her spine and crawl up it until she was sure each new step would bring her in contact with a rock or a small hill and she would stumble face first into the sand. The fourth time she did it, Thorn asked her why they kept slowing down. She kept her eyes open after that. "Do you need to take a break?" Thorn asked, hours later.
No, she huffed, her thighs burning. We're almost to the top of this dune.
Sure, no point passing out from exhaustion. She breathed a sigh of relief upon reaching the top of the dune, but dread quickly took its place. She didn't know why she'd expected this dune to be different from the dozens they'd already crested. She didn't know why she'd been thinking that this must have marked the end of the desert, because she didn't think she could go much farther. But it was not the end. The world was made of more dunes, more sand, more nothingness.
Really, let's take a break, Thorn said,
setting down the pack and stabbing the cane into the ground. He spent a moment working the kinks from his shoulders before hunching over and undoing the bundle's knot. He handed Cress one of the water bottles and took another for himself.
Shouldn't we ration it? She asked.
He shook his head. It's best to drink when we're thirsty, and just try to keep sweating to a minimum, as much as possible. Our bodies will be better able to maintain hydration that way, even if we do run out of water. And we should avoid eating until we find another water source. Digestion uses up a lot of water, too.
That's fine. I'm not hungry.
Which was true. The heat seemed to have stolen what appetite she'd had. When she drank all she could, Cress handed the bottle back to Thorn and fantasized about collapsing into the sand and going to sleep, but she dared not, fearing she would never get up again. When Thorn lifted the pack, she took off down the hill without question.
What do you think is happening on your ship?
Cress asked as they descended the hill. The question had been echoing in her mind for hours, but the water had finally made her capable of speech.
Do you think Mistress Sybil?
They're fine, Thorn said, with unrelenting confidence. I pity the person who goes up against Wolf, and Cinder's made of tougher stuff than people realize. A pause before a hearty laugh burst through the quiet desert air. Literally, in fact.
Wolf, that must be the other man on the ship?
Yes, and Scarlet is his, well, I don't really know what they call themselves, but he's lunatic crazy for her. Scarlet's not a bad shot herself. That thaumaturge had no idea what she was walking into.
Chris hoped he was right. Mr. Sybil had found them because of her, and the guilt was as painful as the deep aches in her bones.
So, how did a girl born on Luna get stuck in a satellite and become an Earthen sympathizer anyway?
She wrinkled her nose.
Well, when my parents found out I was a shell, they gave me up to be killed because of the infanticide laws. But Mistress saved me and raised me instead, along with some other shells she'd rescued. She mostly just wanted us for some sort of experiments they're always running. But Mistress never really explained it to me. We used to live in some of the lava tubes that had been converted into dormitories, and we were always being monitored by these cameras that were connected to Luna's communication system. It was sort of cramped, but not too bad. And we had ports and net screens, so we weren't entirely cut off from the outside world. After a while, I got really good at hacking into the communication system, which I mostly just used for silly stuff. We were all curious about school, so I used to hack into the lunar school system and download the study guides, things like that. Chris squinted up at the moon, now so far away. It was hard to believe it's where she came from. Then one day, one of the older boys, Julian, asked me if I thought I could find out who his parents were. It took a couple days, but I did, and we learned that his parents lived in one of the lumber domes, and that they were both alive, and that he had two younger siblings. And then we figured out how to send them a message and tell them that he was alive. He thought that if they knew he hadn't been killed after all, they would come find him. We got so excited, thinking we could all contact our families, that we would all be rescued. She gulped. It was really naive, of course. The next day, Mistress came and took Julian away, and then some technicians removed all of the monitoring equipment so he couldn't access the net anymore. I never saw Julian again. I think his parents must have contacted the authorities when they got his comm, and I think he may have been killed to prove that the infanticide laws were being taken seriously. She ran her fingers absently through her hair, surprised when they slipped through it so quickly. After that, Mistress Sybil started to pay more attention to me. She sometimes took me out of the caverns and up into the domes and gave me different tasks, altering the coding of the broadcast system, tapping into net links, programming intelligence software to pick up on specific verbal cues and divert information to separate comm accounts. At first, I loved it. Mistress was nice to me then. And it meant I got to leave the lava tubes and see some of the city. I felt like I was becoming her favorite, and that if I did what she asked me to do, eventually it wouldn't matter that I was a shell anymore, and I would be allowed to go to school and be just like any normal lunar. Well, one day Sybil asked me to hack a communication between a couple of European diplomats, and I told her that the signal was too weak. I needed to be closer to Earth, and I required better net connectivity and advanced software. Kress shook her head, remembering how she had told Sybil exactly what Sybil would need to craft the satellite for her young prodigy. Kress had practically designed her own prison. A few months later, Mistress came to get me and told me we were going on a trip. We boarded a pod ship, and I was so, so excited. I thought she was taking me to Artemisia, to be presented to the queen herself, to be forgiven for being born a shell. I feel so stupid now. Even when we started flying away from Luna and I saw that we were heading toward Earth, I thought that's where we were going. I figured, all right, maybe lunars really can't accept me this way, but Mistress knows that Earthens will, so she's letting me go to Earth instead. The trip took hours and hours, and by the end of it, I was shaking with excitement, and I'd worked up this whole story in my head, how Mistress was going to give me to some nice earthen couple, and they would raise me as their own, and they lived in an enormous treehouse. I don't know why I thought they would live in a treehouse, but for some reason, that's what I was hoping for. I mean, I'd never seen real trees. She frowned. Still haven't, actually.
There was a short silence before Thorne said, "And that's when she took you to the satellite, and you became the Queen's programmer."
Programmer, hacker, spy. Somehow, I never stopped believing that if I did everything she asked, someday they would let me go.
And how long before you decided you'd rather be trying to save Earthen royalty than spy on them?
I don't know. I was always fascinated by Earth. I spent a lot of time reading Earthen news and watching their dramas. I started to feel connected to the people down there. Down here. More than I ever did to Lunars. She wrung her hands. After a while, I started to pretend that I was a secret guardian, and it was my job to protect Earth and its people from Lavanna. To her relief, Thorne didn't laugh. He didn't say anything for a long time, and Kress couldn't determine if the silence was comforting or awkward. Maybe he thought her fantasies were childish. A long while later, Thorne finally spoke.
If I'd been in your position, and I had only one DCOM chip that I could use to communicate with Earth, I would have found some dirt on a hotshot spaceship pilot and blackmailed him into coming to get me out of that satellite, rather than trying to rescue the Emperor.
Though he looked serious, Kress couldn't help but smile. No, you wouldn't have. You would have done the same thing I did, because you know that the threat Lavanna poses to Earth is much bigger than you or me. Much bigger than any of us.
But the captain just shook his head. That's very good of you to say, Kress, but trust me, I would have blackmailed someone.
Chapter 19. Kai scooped his hair off his brow, staring at the holograph that floated above the conference table with a mixture of horror and awe. Part of him wanted to laugh. Not at all because it was funny, but because there didn't seem to be any better reaction. The holograph showed the planet Earth, and all around it were hundreds of small yellow lights, many clumped above Earth's most populated cities. Hundreds of tiny spaceships. They were surrounded.
And they're all lunar, he said. We're sure.
Without a doubt, said European Prime Minister Bromstad, his face grouped with the other Earthen Union leaders on the massive net screen. What's most disconcerting is that we were given zero indication of their approach. It's as if they all just flickered into existence, 10,000 kilometers over our heads.
Or, said Queen Camilla of the United Kingdom,
as if they were there all along, but we were unable to detect them. Haven't you been hearing for years about these lunar ships sneaking into our atmosphere, bypassing all of our security measures?
Does it matter how long they've been there or how they got there in the first place? Asked American Republic President Vargas. They're obviously there now, and this is obviously a threat.
Kai squeezed his eyes shut.
But why? She's getting exactly what she wants. Why threaten us now? Why show us her hand?
Perhaps to ensure the Commonwealth doesn't back out of the marriage alliance at the last minute?
Bromstad suggested.
But she has absolutely no reason, Kai huffed and dropped his hand to the back of his chair, what had once been his father's chair. He was far too restless to sit down as he glanced around at his cabinet members and advisors, his country's highly educated experts, who were looking as baffled as he felt.
What do you all make of this?
His experts traded looks among themselves, before Chairman Deschel Hui started to drum his fingers against the table.
It does seem to indicate that they're sending us a message of some sort.
Perhaps this is their way of RSVPing for the wedding, muttered Governor General Williams from Australia.
Perhaps we should ask them,
said Con Torin, tapping a finger against his brow.
If Luna is to become a peaceful ally of the Earthen Union, we might as well start opening the lines of communication.
Naturally, said Africa's Prime Minister Cayman. Kai could all but hear her rolling her eyes. As they've been so open with us in the past.
And you have a better idea?
I certainly do, said Williams. This could be our best chance to reciprocate the recent invasion. We should coordinate a full-scale attack, take out as many of these ships as we can. Show Luna they can't keep threatening us every time Levana throws another fit. If they want to fight, we'll fight.
War, said Prime Minister Kamen. You're suggesting we start a war.
They started the war. I'm suggesting we end it.
Kamen sniffed. And you think our militaries are prepared to launch an attack against an entire fleet of Luna ships? We don't have the faintest idea what type of weaponry they have, and I think the recent attacks illustrated that they're not going to fight by any strategies we're familiar with. They're unpredictable, and as much as it pains me to admit, our military expertise has suffered from generations of peace. Our numbers are down. Few of our men have been trained for space combat.
I agree with Australia, interrupted Queen Camilla. This could be the only time we ever have the element of surprise on our side.
Surprise, barked President Vargas. They're surrounding us. What if they're hoping that we attack them? What if all this drivel about the marriage alliance has been a ruse, just to keep us distracted while they move into position?
Kai's knuckles whitened on the back of the chair.
The alliance isn't a ruse, and nobody is starting a war.
Camilla smirked.
Oh yes, I'd forgotten that the young emperor is so very knowledgeable in these matters.
His blood began to simmer.
This holograph indicates that while these ships may have Earth surrounded, they are still outside the territorial designations of the Earthen Union, correct?
For now, said Governor General Williams.
Right, which means that, for now, these ships aren't violating any terms that we've established with Luna. I'm not saying Levana isn't taunting us or threatening us, but it would be foolish of us to react to it without first coming up with some sort of strategy.
Williams shook his head.
By the time we've finished strategizing, we very well may have been obliterated.
Fine, said Kai, squaring his shoulders. The Treaty of Bremen states we need a majority rule to execute an act of war against any political entity. All in favor to attack these lunar ships, say aye.
Aye,
said Williams and Camilla in unison. The other three leaders remained silent. But Kai could tell from their pinched expressions that no one was happy about it.
Measure fails. Then what do you propose we do?
Asked Queen Camilla.
There is a lunar delegate staying in the palace right now, said Kai, cringing to himself.
I'll speak with him, see if I can figure out what's going on. The alliance negotiations are between Luna and the Commonwealth, so just let me handle it.
He canceled the communication link before the other leaders could argue, or see how frustrated he was becoming. Frustrated that he never knew what Levana was thinking or what she was going to do next. Frustrated that he was bowing to her every whim, and yet she still decided to pull a stunt like this for no apparent reason other than to get the rest of the Union all riled up. Frustrated that, if he were honest with himself, a large part of him agreed that attacking those ships might be the best course of action. But if war broke out, they had no chance of completing the peace alliance, which meant no hope for getting their hands on the Letimosis antidote. He glanced around at the other men and women sitting around the holograph.
Thank you, he said, his voice sounding almost calm.
That will be all.
Your Majesty, said Nancy, rolling into the boardroom as the experts filed out. You have a meeting scheduled with Tajmi Zhe in 6 minutes.
He stifled a groan.
Let me guess, we must be discussing table linens today.
I believe catering staff, Your Majesty.
All right, that sounds like an excellent use of my time. He clipped his port screen to his belt. Let her know I'm on my way.
Thank you for agreeing to meet me out here, said Tajmi Priya, bowing. I thought the fresh air might help you focus on some of the final decisions to be made in regards to the ceremony.
Kai smiled wryly. That's a very diplomatic way of pointing out that I haven't been taking this wedding planning very seriously. Which is probably true.
He tucked his hands into his pockets, amazed at how good the crisp breeze felt on his face. He was still flushed with irritation after the meeting with the union leaders.
Although it is nice to be out here, I feel like I haven't left my office all month.
I suspect there is security footage somewhere to prove that.
They passed by a koi pond, shadowed by the drooping branches of a weeping willow, and surrounded by a patch of the gardens that had been recently dug up and tilled, prepared to replant for the coming autumn season. Smelling the fresh earth, Kai was momentarily baffled at how the life of the palace continued, how the life of the city and the Commonwealth and all of Earth had gone on, even while he'd locked himself in that office and racked his brain for some way to protect it all.
Your Majesty?
He started. Yes, I'm sorry. He gestured at a simple stone bench. Shall we?
Priya adjusted the fabric of her sari as she sat down. The gold and orange fish swarmed to the rocky barrier of the pond, hoping for food.
I wanted to speak with you about an idea I've had regarding the hired vendors that will be assisting with the wedding ceremony. But it's one that I don't think Her Lunar Majesty would approve. Nevertheless, I thought the decision should be yours.
Hired vendors?
Caterers, footmen, ushers, florists, and the like.
Kai adjusted the cuff of his shirt.
Oh, right, go on.
I thought it might be prudent to staff the event with a mix of humans and androids.
He shook his head. Lavanna would never stand for it.
Yes, that's why I would suggest we use escort droids that she would not recognize as such.
He stiffened. Escorts?
We would use only the most realistic models. We could even place special orders for those with more humanoid characteristics. Complexion flaws, natural hair and eye colors, varying body types and bone structures. I would be sure to find androids that wouldn't draw attention to themselves.
Kai opened his mouth to refute again, but paused. Escort droids were designed mostly for companionship. It would be an insult of the highest order if Lavanna became aware that they were at her wedding ceremony. But
they can't be brainwashed.
Priya was silent for a moment before continuing.
We could also use them to record the proceedings, in case Her Majesty or her guests attempt anything untoward.
Has Lavanna insisted on having no cameras again? The Queen hated being recorded, and she demanded there be no recording devices at the annual ball when she was his special guest.
No, Your Majesty, the Queen recognizes the importance of this event being broadcast on an international scope. She's put up no resistance on that front.
He released a breath.
However, with androids, we could ensure that we'll have eyes everywhere, so to speak. She shrugged. Hopefully, this would be a precaution that is unnecessary.
Kai fidgeted with his cuff. It was a smart idea. The most powerful men and women on Earth would be at this ceremony, making it awfully easy for Lavanna to abuse her powers of manipulation. Having loyal staff who couldn't be affected could be an insurance policy against a worldwide political catastrophe. But Lavanna hated androids. If she found out, she would be livid. And he'd like to avoid any more outbursts from the Queen if he could.
Thank you for the recommendation, he said. When do you need a decision?
The end of this week, if we're to place the order in time.
I'll let you know.
Thank you, Your Majesty. Also, I wanted to tell you of a small realization I had this morning that amounts to one more benefit in broadcasting the nuptials.
What's that?
Her Majesty refuses to remove her veil while in the presence of any recording devices, and so she will wear it throughout the wedding and coronation.
Reaching forward, she patted Kai's wrist.
Which means you won't have to kiss her.
He couldn't help a sharp laugh.
The knowledge did relieve a bit of his terror, but it was also a painful reminder. He figured he would still have to kiss her eventually. The thought made him sick.
Thank you, Tajmi Jia. That does make it slightly less horrific.
Her whole face softened.
May I speak openly, Your Majesty?
Of course. She withdrew her hand and knotted her fingers on her lap.
I don't mean to overstep any professional boundaries, but I have a son, you see. He's about a year older than you are.
Kai gulped, surprised at a tinge of guilt. He had never imagined who this woman might be when she left the palace every day. He had never bothered to picture her with a family.
Lately, I've tried to imagine what this would be like on him, Priya continued, gazing up at the drooping tree branches.
The leaves were changing to gold, and every now and then a breeze would shake some loose and send them pinwheeling down to the pond.
What kind of toll would be paid for a young man with these responsibilities, forced to make these decisions?
She took in a deep breath, as if she regretted her words before she said them.
As a mother, I'm worried about you.
He met her gaze, and his heart lurched.
Thank you, he said. But you needn't worry. I'm doing my best.
She smiled gently.
Oh, I know you are. But Your Majesty, I've been planning this wedding for 12 days, and I've seen you age years in that time. It pains me to think how much harder everything will become after the wedding.
I'll have Torin still, and the cabinet, and the province reps. I'm not alone. Even as he said it, he felt the jolt of a lie. He wasn't alone, was he? Anxiety crawled up his throat. Of course he wasn't. He had an entire country behind him, and all the people in the palace, and no one. No one could truly understand what he was risking, what sacrifice he may be making. Torin was smart enough to realize it, of course, but at the end of the day, he still had his own home to return to. And Kai hadn't confided in him that he and Nancy were searching for Princess Celine again. He would never tell Torin that a part of him hoped Cinder would be safe. And he would never tell a single living soul how terrified he was every moment of every day. How afraid he was that he was making an enormous mistake.
I'm sorry, Your Majesty, Priya said. I'd hoped, if it wasn't too forward of me, that I might offer some motherly advice.
He pressed his fingertips onto the cool stone of the bench. Perhaps I could use some of that. Priya adjusted her sari on her shoulder, the gold embroidery catching in the sunlight.
Try to find something that makes you happy. Your life is not going to get easier once Queen Lavanna is your wife. If you had even one small thing that brought you happiness, or hope that things could someday be better, then maybe that would be enough to sustain you. Otherwise, I fear it will be too easy for the Queen to win.
And what would you suggest? Priya shrugged.
Perhaps this garden is a good place to start?
Following her gesture, Kai took in the stalks of bamboo bowing over the stone walls, the myriad lilies beginning to fade after summer's long showing, the bright fish that clustered and pressed against each other, ignorant of the turmoil in the world above their small pond. It was beautiful, but...
You aren't convinced, said Priya.
He forced a smile.
It's good advice. I just don't know if I have the energy to be happy right now about anything.
Priya seemed sad at his response, though not surprised.
Please, think about it. You deserve a respite every now and then. We all do, but you more than anyone.
He shrugged, but it had no enthusiasm. I'll keep that in mind.
That's all I can ask,
Priya stood, and Kai rose to join her.
Thank you for your time. Let me know your decision on the escort droids.
Kai waited until she returned to the palace before settling onto the bench again. A slender golden leaf fluttered into his lap
and he picked it up, twirling it between his fingers. Priya's advice had merit. One bit of happiness, of hope, could make the difference in preserving his sanity, but it was a request easier made than fulfilled. He did have some happiness to look forward to, seeing Lavanna's signature on the Treaty of Bremen, distributing her antidote and eradicating his planet of this awful plague. But those victories would come hand in hand with a lifetime of attending celebratory balls with Lavanna at his side. And next time, Cinder wouldn't be there to distract him. Though admittedly, that lifetime might be cut shorter than expected. It was a morbid thought that his premature death would at least keep him from too many painful dances. He sighed, his thoughts circling back to Cinder. He couldn't avoid thinking about her these days, maybe because her name was at the top of every report, every newsfeed. The girl he'd invited to the ball. The girl he'd wanted to dance with. He thought of that moment, spotting her at the top of the staircase, her hair and dress drenched from the rain, noticing that she wore the gloves he'd given her. A smile tugged at him. It probably wasn't what Priya had in mind, the most hopeless situation of all. His relationship with Cinder, if it could even be called that, had been fleeting and bittersweet. Maybe if things were different. Maybe if he wasn't marrying Lavanna. Maybe if he'd had a chance to ask Cinder the questions that plagued him. Had it all been a deception? Had she ever considered telling him the truth? Maybe then he could imagine a future in which they could start again. But the engagement was very real, and Cinder was... He jerked forward, nearly crushing the leaf in his fist. Cinder was searching for Princess Selene, had maybe even found her. That knowledge was fraught with its own questions. What were Cinder's motives, and what was she doing now? How would the people of Luna react when Princess Selene returned? What kind of person had she become? Would she even want her throne back? Despite the lingering doubts, he did believe that Selene was alive. He believed she was the true heir to the lunar throne, and that she could end Lavanna's reign. He believed that Cinder, who had proven to be the most resilient and resourceful person he'd ever known, actually stood a chance of finding her and keeping her safe, and revealing her true identity to the world. It may have been a fragile hope, but right now, it was the best hope he had. Chapter 20. Cress awoke to a dizzying assortment of sensations. Her legs throbbed and the bottoms of her feet ached. The weight of the sand that they'd buried themselves in to keep warm pressed down on her from neck to toes. Her scalp was still tingling from its strange new lightness. Her skin felt dry and scratchy, her lips brittle. Thorn stirred beside her, moving slowly so as not to disturb the square of parachute material they'd draped over themselves to keep wind-blown sand out of their faces, though the grains in Cress's ears and nose proved that it hadn't been entirely effective. Every inch of her body was covered in the stuff. Sand under her fingernails, sand at the corners of her lips, sand in her hair and in the folds of her earlobes. Attempting to rub the dry sleep from her eyelashes proved a difficult, painstaking operation. "Hold still," said Thorn, settling a palm on her arm. "The tarp may have gathered some dew. We shouldn't let it go to waste."
Dew?
Water that comes up from the ground in the morning. She knew what dew was, but it seemed silly to expect it in this landscape. Still, the air did seem almost damp around her, and she didn't argue when Thorn instructed her to find the tarp's corners and lift them up, sending whatever moisture there was down to its middle. What they found when they had shimmied out from beneath it was a little less than a single gulp of water, muddied from the sand that had blown up onto the fabric overnight. She described their underwhelming success to Thorn
and watched disappointment crease his brow, though it soon faded with a shrug.
At least we still have plenty of water from the satellite.
Plenty being their last two bottles full. Kress looked out at the brightening horizon. After walking nearly the entire night, Kress doubted they could have slept for more than a couple of hours, and her feet felt like they would fall off with the next step. She was disheartened when she looked up at the mountains and discovered that they didn't seem any closer now than they had the evening before.
"How are your eyes?" she asked.
"Well, I've been told they're dreamy, but I'll let you decide for yourself." Flushing, she turned back to him. Thorn had his arms crossed over his chest and a devil-may-care grin, but there was something strained beneath it. She realized that the lightness in his tone had also rung false, covering up whatever frustrations were simmering just beneath his cavalier attitude.
"I couldn't disagree," she murmured.
Though she immediately wanted to crawl back beneath the parachute and hide from embarrassment, it was worth it to see Thorne's grin become a little less forced. They packed up their camp, drank some water, and retied the towels around Kress's ankles, all while the taunting morning dew steamed and disappeared around them. The temperature was already climbing. Before closing up their pack, Thorne shook out the sheets and made Kress wrap one around herself like a robe, then adjusted his own sheet to make a hooded cloak that came over his brow.
"Is your head covered?" he asked, brushing his foot along the ground until he found the metal bar he'd been using as a cane.
Kress tried her best to mimic the way he'd covered himself before confirming that it was.
"Good. Your skin is going to crisp up like bacon soon enough.
This will help for a little while, at least." She fidgeted with the cumbersome sheet while trying to guide Thorne up the slope they'd camped on. She was still exhausted and half numb from walking. Every limb throbbed. They hadn't traversed four dunes before Kress stumbled, landing on her knees. Thorne dug his heels into the ground for purchase.
"Kress?"
"I'm fine," she said, pulling herself up and rubbing the sand from her shins. "Just a little drained. I'm not used to all this exercise." Thorne's hands were hanging in midair, like he'd meant to help pull her to her feet, but she noticed it too late. Slowly, they sank to his sides.
"Can you keep going?"
"Yes, I just need to get into a rhythm again." She hoped it was true, and that her legs wouldn't be loose cables all day long.
"We'll walk until it gets too hot, then rest. We don't want to exert ourselves too much, especially under full sun."
Kress started down the dune again, counting their steps to bide the time. 10 steps, 25, 50. The sand grew hot, singeing the soles of her feet through the towels. The sun climbed. Her imagination circled through her favorite fantasies, anything to keep herself distracted. She was a shipwrecked pirate from the Second Era. She was an athlete training for a cross-country journey. She was an android who had no sense of exhaustion, who could march on and on and on. But the dreams became more and more fleeting, reality pushing them aside with pain and discomfort and thirst. She began to hope that Thorne would let them stop and relax, but he didn't. They trudged on. Thorne was right about the sheets, which kept the merciless sun from scorching her, and she became grateful for the dampness of her own sweat keeping her cool. She began counting again as sweat dripped down the backs of her knees, and though she felt awful for thinking it, part of her was glad Thorne couldn't see her in this state. Not that he was immune to the trials of the desert. His face was red, his hair messed from rubbing against his makeshift hood, and dirt streaked down his cheeks where there was a shadow of facial hair. As it grew hotter, Thorne encouraged Kress to finish off the water they'd opened in the morning, which she drank with relish, only afterward realizing that Thorne hadn't taken any for himself. She was still thirsty, but the day was stretching on in front of them,
and they had only one more bottle. Though Thorne had told her they shouldn't ration it, she couldn't bring herself to ask for more if he wasn't drinking also. She began to sing to herself to pass the time, humming all the pretty songs she could recall from her music collection on the satellite. She let the familiar melodies distract her. Walking became easier for a time.
That one's pretty.
She paused, and it took a moment for her to realize Thorne was talking about the song she was singing. And it took another moment for her to remember which one it had been.
Thank you, she said uncertainly.
She'd never sang in front of anyone, never been complimented on it.
It's a popular lullaby on Luna. I used to think that I'd been named for it before I realized what a common name Crescent is. She sang through the first verse again. Sweet crescent moon, up in the sky, you sing your song so sweetly after sunshine passes by.
When she glanced back at Thorne, he had a faint smile on his lips. Your mom sang you a lot of lullabies?
Oh, no. They can tell you're a shell right when you're born, so I was only a few days when my parents gave me up to be killed. I don't remember them at all.
His smile disappeared, and after a long silence, he said,
You probably shouldn't be singing now that I think of it. You'll lose moisture through your mouth.
Oh.
Pressing her lips tight together, Cress placed her fingertips against Thorne's arm, the signal that had come to mean they were starting down a slope, and slogged on. Her skin had been scraped raw by the heat, despite the shelter of her makeshift robe. But she was propelled on by the thought that it was nearly midday, and while midday would bring about the highest temperatures yet, Thorne had also promised a respite from walking.
All right. Thorne finally said, as if the words were being dragged up from his throat. That's enough. Let's rest until the temperature goes down again.
Cress groaned with relief. She would have kept walking all day if he had asked it of her, but how glad she was that he hadn't.
Do you see any shade at all? Or someplace that looks like it might be shaded when the sun starts going down?
Cress squinted across the dunes. Though there was some shade over the occasional hillock, at high noon, it was almost non-existent. Still, they were coming up on a big hill that would soon cast some shadows. It was the best they could do.
This way, she said, spurred on by the promise of rest.
But as they crested one more dune, her eye caught on something in the distance. She gasped, grabbing Thorne's arm.
What is it?
She gaped at the glorious sight, struggling to find words to describe it. Blue and green, a stark contrast against the orange desert sand.
Water and trees.
An oasis?
Yes, it must be.
Relief spilled over her. She began to tremble with the promise of shade, water, rest.
Come on, it isn't far,
she said, plowing through the sand with renewed energy. Cress, wait, reserve your energy.
But we're almost there.
Cress! She barely heard him. Already she could imagine the cool water slipping down her throat, the breeze beneath a palm's canopy. Maybe there would be food, some strange tropical earthen food she'd never tasted, that would be juicy and crisp and refreshing. But mostly, she thought of collapsing into a nice patch of shade, cooled and protected from the sun, and sleeping until nighttime brought the return of cooler temperatures and endless stars. Thorne trooped after her, having given up trying to make her stop, and soon she realized she was being cruel to make him go so fast. She slowed a little, but kept her eyes on the lake that shimmered at the base of a dune.
Cress, are you sure?
He asked when he'd caught his breath.
Of course I'm sure. It's right there.
But, Cress, her pace slowed.
What's wrong? Are you hurt?
He shook his head. No, just, all right, I can keep up. Let's get to this oasis. She beamed and grabbed his free hand, leading him over the desert's ripples and tides.
Her fantasies took over, eclipsing her fatigue. The towels had nearly rubbed the soles of her feet raw, and her calves were sunburned where her sheet didn't protect them, and her brain was swirling with thirst. But they were close, so close. And yet, as she slipped along the powdery sand, it seemed that the oasis never came any closer. It always lingered at the horizon, as if the shimmering trees were receding with each step she took. She plowed on, desperate. The distances were deceptive, but soon they would reach it, if only they kept moving, one step at a time, one foot in front of the other.
Cress.
Captain, she panted, it isn't far.
Cress, is it getting any closer?
She stumbled, her pace slowing drastically until she stopped, gasping for breath. Captain?
Do you see it getting closer? Do the trees look bigger than they were before?
She squinted at the water, the trees, the most gorgeous sight, and swiped her sleeve over her face. She was so hot, but no sweat was left behind on the cloth. The truth was so painful she almost didn't have the strength to say it.
No, but that's... How could...
Thorn sighed, but it was not a disappointed sigh, merely resigned.
It's a mirage, Cress. It's the light playing tricks on your eyes.
But I can see it. There are even islands in the lake and trees.
I know. Mirages always seem real, but you're only seeing what you want to see. It's a trick, Cress. It's not there.
She was mesmerized by how the water rippled in little waves, how the trees trembled like a breeze was teasing their branches. It looked so real, so tangible. She could almost smell it, almost taste the cool wind blowing toward her. Cress barely managed to stay standing, her fear of being scorched by the hot sand alone giving her the strength.
It's all right. Lots of people see mirages in the desert.
But I didn't know. I should have known. I've heard stories, but I didn't think it could look so real.
Thorn's fingers brushed against the sheet, finding her hand.
You're not going to cry, are you?
He said, his tone a mixture of gentle and stern. Crying was not allowed, not with water so precious.
No,
she whispered, and she meant it. Not that she didn't want to cry, but because she wasn't sure her body could make enough tears.
Good. Come on, find us a sand dune to sit down for a while.
Cress peeled her attention away from the fleeting, bitter illusion. Scanning the nearest dunes, she led him toward a southward-facing slope. The moment she was over the crest, it was as if a thin string that had been holding her up snapped. Cress let out a pained groan and collapsed into the sand. Thorn brought the blanket and parachute square out of the pack and laid it out for them to sit on, to keep them off the hot sand, then pulled the corners over their heads like a canopy that blocked out the sun's brightness. He put an arm around Cress's shoulders and tugged her against him. She felt so dumb, so betrayed, by the desert, by the sun, by her own eyes. And now the truth was settling upon her. There was no water. There were no trees. Nothing but endless sand, endless sun, endless walking. And they may never make it out. They couldn't go on forever. She doubted she could go on for another day like this. And who knew how long it would take to reach the end of the desert? Not when every sand dune multiplied into three more, when every step toward the mountains seemed to send them even farther into the distance, and they didn't even know that the mountains would offer any protection when they got there.
We are not going to die here, Thorn said, his voice soft and reassuring, like he'd known exactly where her thoughts had been taking her. I've been through much worse than this, and I've survived just fine.
You have?
He opened his mouth, but paused.
Well, I was in jail for a long time, which wasn't exactly a picnic.
She adjusted the towels on her feet. The hair ropes had begun to cut into her skin.
The military wasn't much fun either, come to think of it.
You were only in it for 5 months, she murmured, and most of that was spent in flight training.
Thorn tilted his head. How'd you know that?
Research.
She didn't tell him just how much she'd researched into his past, and he didn't ask.
Well, so maybe this is the worst I've been through.
But it doesn't change the fact that we're going to survive. We'll find civilization. We'll calm the Rampian, and they'll come get us. Then we'll overthrow Levana, and I'll get loads of reward money, and the Commonwealth will pardon my crimes, or whatever, and we'll all live happily ever after.
Cress nestled against Thorn's side, trying to believe him.
But first, we have to get out of this desert.
He rubbed her shoulder. It was the kind of touch that would have filled her with giddiness and yearning if she hadn't been too tired to feel anything.
You have to trust me, Cress. I'm going to get us out of this.
Chapter 21.
There, said Dr. Erland, snipping off the ends of the surgery thread. That's all I can do for him.
Cinder wet her lips and found that they had begun to split from dryness.
And will he... Is he going to...
We have to wait and see.
He's lucky the bullets didn't puncture a lung, or he wouldn't have made it this far, but he did lose a lot of blood.
I'll monitor the anesthetics closely for the next day or two. We want to keep him sedated. Levana soldiers are designed as disposable weapons. They are very effective when they're in good health, but their genetic alterations make it difficult for them to rest, even when their bodies need time to recover from injury.
She stared down at Wolf's wounds, now sewed together with dark blue thread that formed ugly bumps and ridges where open flesh had been before. Numerous other scars littered his bare chest, long since healed. It was obvious that he'd been through a lot. Surely this wouldn't be the end of him, after everything. A table beside her held a tray with the two small bullets the doctor had removed. They seemed too small to have done so much damage.
I can't let anyone else die, she whispered.
The doctor looked up from cleaning the surgical tools.
They may be treated as disposable assets to the Queen, but they are also resilient.
He dropped the scalpel and tweezers into a blue liquid.
With proper rest, it's possible that he'll make a full recovery.
Possible, she repeated dumbly. It wasn't enough. She slumped down onto the wooden chair beside Wolf's bed and slipped a hand into his, hoping he would appreciate the touch, even though she wasn't Scarlet. She crushed her eyes shut, the wave of remorse flooding over her. Scarlet. Wolf would be furious when he woke up. Furious and devastated.
Now, perhaps you might deign to tell me how you managed to be in the company of both a lunar soldier and a lunar royal guard of all of the possible allies in this galaxy?
She sighed. It took a while to gather her thoughts and find the beginning of such a story. Ultimately, she decided to tell him about tracking down Michel Benoit and how she'd been hoping to find out more about the woman who had protected her secret to the death. How she'd been searching for clues about her past, who had brought her to Earth, and why anyone would put so much faith into a child who, at the time, was a mere 3 years old and on the brink of death after the Queen's attempted murder. She explained how they'd followed the path of clues to Paris, where she learned that Michel Benoit was dead. But she found her granddaughter instead, Scarlet and Wolf. How they became allies, how Wolf was training her to use her mental abilities and to fight. She told him about the attack aboard the Rampian and how Sybil Mira had taken Scarlet, and now it was only her and Wolf. And this guard, who she wanted to trust, felt she needed to trust, and yet she didn't even know his name. He said that he serves his princess, Cinder said, the words wispy and thin. Somehow he knew about me. Erland rubbed at his frizzy hair.
Perhaps he overheard Thaumaturge Mira or the queen herself talking about you.
We're lucky that his fealty is to the true crown.
Many of Lavanna's minions would just as soon kill you and claim a reward than see you recognized as queen.
I figured as much. He sneered, like he wasn't happy to have to acknowledge the guard could be an ally after all.
And speaking of recognizing you as the true queen, she shriveled into her seat, squeezing Wolf's hand.
Miss Lynn, I have spent years planning for the time when I would find you again. You should have come to me straight away.
Cinder wrinkled her nose.
That's precisely why I didn't. And what does that mean?
When you came to my jail cell and dropped this whole princess thing on me, how was I supposed to react? All of a sudden, I went from being nobody to being long-lost royalty. And you expected me to jump up and accept this destiny that you'd worked out in your head? But did you ever consider that maybe that's not the destiny I want? I wasn't raised to be a princess or a leader. I just needed some time to figure out who I was, am, where I came from. I thought maybe those answers were in France.
And were they?
She shrugged, remembering the underground lab they'd found on the Benoit farm, with a suspended animation tank where she had slept, half alive, for 8 years. Where some nameless, faceless person had given her a new name, a new history, and new robotic limbs. Some of them were.
And how about now? Are you ready to accept your destiny? Or are you still searching?
She frowned. I know that I am who you say I am. And someone has to stop Lavanna. If that someone has to be me, well, yes, I accept that. I'm ready. She glanced down at Wolf and bit back her next words.
At least, I thought I was ready before I ruined everything.
Good, said the doctor. Because it's time we developed a plan. Queen Lavanna cannot be allowed to rule any longer, and she certainly cannot be allowed to rule Earth.
I know, I agree. I had a plan, actually. We had a plan. He raised an eyebrow at her. We were going to use the wedding to our advantage, especially with all the media that's going to be there. We were going to get past palace security, and I was going to sneak into the ceremony and stop it.
Stop the wedding, Erland said, sounding unimpressed.
Yes, I was going to tell everyone who I am, with all the cameras and the media and the whole world watching. I was going to insist that Kai couldn't marry her. I was going to tell the world about Lavanna's plans to invade all the earthen countries so that the other leaders would refuse to accept her as a world leader. And then I would demand that Lavanna relinquish her crown.
To me.
She pulled away from Wolf, finding that her palm had grown too warm. She rubbed it nervously on her pant leg. Dr. Erlon's expression had gone dark. He reached forward and pinched Cinder hard above her elbow.
Ow! Hey! For a moment, I thought you must be another one of my hallucinations, as surely your plan couldn't be that stupid.
It's not stupid. The news would go viral in minutes. There's nothing Lavanna could do to stop it.
It certainly would go viral. Everyone would be clamoring to witness the tirade of the crazy cyborg who fancies herself a princess.
They could test my blood, like you did. I can prove it.
No doubt Her Majesty would stand by patiently while you did so.
He huffed, as if he were talking to a small child.
Queen Lavanna has her talons so deep into the Commonwealth that you would be dead before you finished the word princess. Your Emperor Kai would do anything to appease her right now, to ensure that war doesn't break out again, and to get his hands on that Letmosis antidote. He wouldn't risk angering her just to validate the claim of a 16-year-old girl who is already a wanted criminal.
She crossed her arms.
He might?
He raised an eyebrow at her, and she sulked in her chair. Fine, Cinder said. What do you suggest?
You clearly know all about this political revolution stuff, so please enlighten me, O wrinkled one.
Dr. Erlund grabbed his hat off a small writing desk and pulled it onto his head.
You can begin by learning some manners, or no one will ever believe you could be royalty.
Right. I'm sure that poor etiquette is the number one reason for most failed revolutions.
Are you quite finished?
Not hardly. He pinned her with a glare, and she glared right back. Finally, Cinder rolled her eyes.
Yes, I'm finished.
Good, because we have a lot to discuss, beginning with how we're going to get you to Luna.
Luna?
Yes, Luna, the rock in the sky that you're destined to rule. I trust you're familiar with it.
You expect me to go to Luna?
Not today, but eventually, yes. You're wasting your time with this wedding business and viral media. The people of Luna don't care what the people of Earth think. Proclaiming your identity here won't persuade them to rebel against their monarch or crown you as their queen.
Of course it will. I'm the rightful heir. She drew back, stunned by her own words. She didn't think she'd ever felt so invested in her identity or determined to claim her place. It was a strange feeling, bordering on pride.
You are the rightful heir, said the doctor. But you have to convince the people of Luna, not the people of Earth. The lunar people must be informed that you are alive. Only with them on your side can you expect to have any success in claiming your birthright. Of course, Lavanna will not give up easily.
She massaged her neck, waiting for the adrenaline warnings to dissipate.
Fine. Let's say you're right, and this is the only way. How are we supposed to get on Luna? Aren't all the entry ports underground? And, I might guess, heavily monitored?
Precisely my point. We must find a way to sneak you through the ports.
Obviously, we can't use your ship, he trailed off, rubbing his cheek.
It will require careful strategizing.
Oh, good. More strategizing. My favorite.
In the meantime, I suggest you not venture too far outside the heart of this town, and stay inside your ship as much as possible. It isn't entirely safe here.
Cinder glowered. In case you didn't notice, everyone already saw me. There's no hiding me now.
That isn't what I mean. This area has suffered more cases of letimosis than any other on Earth. Although there haven't been any severe breakouts in over a year, we can't let our guard down. Not with you.
I'm immune. Remember? That little discovery that kicked off this whole mess?
He sighed, long and slow. The defeat in his expression shot a dart of worry down her spine.
Doctor? I have seen evidence that the disease is mutating, said Dr. Erlund, and that lunars may no longer be immune. At least, not all of us.
Her skin began to crawl. It was amazing how fast the old fears returned. After weeks of being invincible in the face of one of Earth's most merciless killers, the threat was back. Her immunity could be compromised. And she was in Africa, where it had all started.
A knock startled them both. The guard stood in the hall, damp from a recent shower and wearing some earthen military clothes found aboard the Rampion. Though his wounds were no longer visible, Cinder noticed that he was carrying himself stiffly, favoring his unwounded side. In his hands was a tray of flatbread that smelled thickly of garlic.
Heard you talking. I thought your surgery might be finished, he said. How's your friend?
Cinder glanced at Wolf. He, too, would be vulnerable. Everyone in this room was lunar, she realized with a jolt. If Dr. Erlund was right, they were all vulnerable now.
Cinder had to swallow to unclog her voice. He's still alive. Leaving Wolf's side, she held a hand toward the guard. I'm Cinder, by the way.
He squinted. I know who you are.
Yeah, but I figured a formal introduction would be nice, now that we're on the same side.
Is that what you've decided?
Cinder frowned, but before she could respond, he'd shifted the flatbread to his other hand and grasped hers.
Jason Clay. Honored.
Not knowing how to read his tone, which sounded almost mocking, Cinder pulled away and glanced at the doctor, who had his fingers pressed against Wolf's wrist. Evidently, he had no intention of joining the introductions. Cinder wiped her palms on her pants and eyed the tray.
So what, you can shoot a gun, fly a spaceship, and bake?
This was brought by some kids. He pushed the tray toward Cinder. They said it was for you, but I told them you couldn't be bothered.
She took it awkwardly.
For me?
The cyborg, to be specific. Seemed unlikely there would be two of you around.
Huh. I wonder why.
I suspect it will not be the first gift you receive from the citizens of Farafra, said Dr. Erland.
What for? These people don't know me.
Of course they do. Or at least, they know of you. We are not so cut off from the world here as you might think. Even I had a reputation when I first arrived.
She set the tray down on the desk. And they haven't turned you in? What about the reward money? And the fact you're a lunar? Don't they care? Instead of answering, Dr. Erland slid his gaze toward Jason, who was now leaning statue-like beside the door. It was easy to forget his presence in a room when he stood so still and said so little. No doubt his training as a guard had taught him that. No doubt he was used to going unnoticed. But while Cinder had made the choice to trust him, it was obvious from the doctor's expression that she was so far alone in that decision.
Right, said Jason, pushing himself off the wall. I'll go check on your ship. Make sure no one's backing out screws and calling them souvenirs.
He left the hotel room without looking back, his limp almost passing for a swagger.
I know, he seems a little abrasive, Cinder said once he was gone.
But he knows who I am, and he saved my life, and Wolf's. We should treat him as an ally.
You may choose to reveal all your secrets, Miss Lin, but it does not mean I must reveal mine, or those of the people in this town.
What do you mean?
The people here do not care that we are lunar, because we are not the only ones. I estimate 15% of the population of Farafra
and other neighboring oases is made up of lunars, or those of lunar descent.
This is where many of our people choose to come after they escape, and they have been immigrating here since the time of Queen Chanary,
perhaps even earlier.
15%? She asked. And the Earthens know?
It is not widely discussed, but it seems to be common knowledge.
They have come to live in harmony together. Once the plague struck, many lunars took to nursing the sick and burying the dead, as they themselves did not catch the sickness.
Of course, no one knew they were the original carriers.
By the time that theory was posed, the two races had become too intermingled. They work together now, helping each other survive.
But it's illegal to harbor lunar fugitives. Lavanna would be furious.
Yes, but who would tell her? No one cares about a poor, diseased town in the Sahara.
Thought swarming, she picked up a piece of the bread, glistening with golden oil and speckled with herbs. The soft inside was still steaming when she pulled it apart. It was a gift. From lunars. From her own people. Her eyes widened, and she gaped up at the doctor again.
Do they know about me?
She sniffed.
They know that you stood up against the queen. They know that you continue to defy her.
For the first time since she'd arrived, Cinder thought she detected a smile beneath the doctor's annoyed expression.
And I may have led them to believe that one of these days you intend to assassinate her.
What? Assassinate her?
It worked, he said with an unapologetic shrug. These people will follow you anywhere.